We have the handouts for tomorrow. Do we have the French edition yet?
Yeah, I've copied the one, the book that you gave me.
But I mean the transliteration.
I always have to go after class.
Are you going to go after class? Okay. So maybe we can start it tomorrow.
Okay.
So Wednesday. Yeah, start it tomorrow. Om Sahana Vatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvina Vadhitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. I was thinking about another thing that I think is kind of useful and important to explore. It has to do with your relationship with God when you were little and the beliefs of your parents. It's something I always say, even at CIS when I'm teaching spiritual counseling, and also if I'm teaching what a course that's called Eastern Themes of Self, Mind, and Nature. The containing myth of the East, or the God image, what God is to us, is very different in these two kind of cultures, you know, the West and the East. It's very different. And what happens, unless we really kind of do that work about getting really in touch with our childhood beliefs, the beliefs we grow up with, you know, and the beliefs that our parents have. There's a couple of things that happens. The most typical thing is that when we say Ishwara, or if we use the word God, which I actually don't use that very much, but then Ishwara translates as God, that God image somehow gets superimposed upon the how you think about God or feel about God when you are little. And so that God image, like I told my mother, you know, God has a white angel wings and a big white beard and a dressed in white and is up there in the heavens looking down on everybody. So that's very kind of a typical archetypal figure of God. You can actually see God portrayed in that way, you know. And it's not really even that she would laugh when she was saying that, but that's what she grew up with. That image is what she grew up with. And so when we think in the West, often when we think of God, it's somebody up in the heavens who's looking down on us and who, from some, depending upon how you were raised, the one who more or less judges us, you know, is critical of us or is angry with us or has the lightning bolt. For some people, like, he has the lightning bolt, and when you're good, then he praises you. So he's subject Yahweh in the Old Testament and the New Testament is capable of great anger and great rage. You know, when I go into the New Testament, that angry God is a little bit sublated by Jesus as an intermediary. You know, and so most of us, many of us, some of us still, for us, Christianity is still alive. And those, the images, what we call the containing myth. The containing myth means all of the stories. Like when I was a little girl and would go to Sunday school, we'd have so many Bible stories, and at home we had Bible stories that we would read and our parents would read to us. You know, and then at Christmas we would read Bible stories, like this kind of thing. Even though they weren't particularly religious, but they were religious enough to go to church for some time until my father said, I just want to work out in the yard. I don't want to have to give up my Sunday anymore. But we had to go to Sunday school and church and all that, and we grew up as Christians, and we didn't even think of that we were growing up as Christians. It's that Christianity was the religion. I didn't even know about any other religion. Once a friend of the family, and also one of my father's patients, but they were friends of the family. They were Jewish, and they had been in the Holocaust. And one time the family, the mother and father, came over, and they had these numbers on their arm. And I was looking at these numbers, and he showed me these numbers, but, you know, he said something, but of course I was young and we didn't get into it. I didn't have any idea. And I also didn't have any idea what it meant to be Jewish or Christian, one versus the other. I didn't know what that meant, you know, until I was much older, maybe a teenager. I started to learn about all of these things. Otherwise, I wasn't that interested, and I just didn't know. And so there was a God, and that was the only God. And then Christianity was the only religion. And those beliefs, whatever they were the beliefs. Period. Because I had no idea of anything else. You know, and maybe it's a little different for your generation. You know, you're a couple of generations. I'm a couple of ahead of you. And so maybe the level of ignorance was a little bit more at that time, at least in the little town that I was living in. But the point is this, is that you are, as a child, you know, you have your mother and father who are kind of the devatas for you, and they're the ones that provide your world for you. They take care of you completely, and they know what to do, you know. And so they're the ones who are, in a way, your God. And then how what they believe is what trickles down into you also. And what they teach, what they believe, because you pick that up just, you know, kind of like osmosis. It just kind of penetrates that value system. And their relationship with God penetrates also. You know, even if they don't talk much about it. It's also true culturally. Say if you grow up in a Jewish community, or you grow up in a Christian community versus a Buddhist community or a Hindu community, that community psyche, communal psyche, is carrying a certain God. When Jungian psychology, you call it a God image, you know, a certain God image, a certain set of beliefs and understandings around God, and that then that's going to affect very much your relationship with God. And so that emotional, embodied relationship is there from a very early age. And then when you become an adult or a rebellious teenager, or even in your early 20s, you can find yourself kind of, well, I want to do this, I want to try this out or that out, and kind of separating yourself from it, you know. But you're separating it in your mind. It's an intellectual separation. It's not an unconscious separation. And so while you're doing this intellectual separation, and, you know, taking on some other religion or some other culture, like Hinduism, for instance, it was quite different from the West. But if you're taking on those beliefs and those understandings, intellectually it's fine. But it's not necessarily fine at all emotionally. So, and you might not even be aware of that. What happens in some instances is that what the Vedanta is saying, what the Upanishads are saying, just go through the Christian filter, you know. And so in that way it gets quite distorted. I know that from reading books by Christian monks, Christian priests who have spent a lot of time in India and in more or less are adopting much of the Vedanta. But when you read their books or listen to them, They're adopting the Vedanta through a Christian perspective. It's just, and they feel very fine about that, and I think actually it probably blesses that religion, but you can't really call it Vedanta. It's a Vedantic, imbibing some Vedanta within the Christian containing myth. And so what I'm saying is, say, for people like us, for Westerners, even if you weren't raised in necessarily religious family, the culture is a carrier often of a particular religion. And so the whole value system, the whole way we think of God and all of these words, for instance, how we define these words, how we define heaven and hell and purgatory for the Catholics, even that those are the words that we have. In India, they have different words. It's not just heaven and hell and purgatory. You know, there are many different lokas that you can, because of your punya and papa, you can go and stay in those for some time and you always come back. That's not the same as heaven and hell, right? But we don't have that one. If you get that one at all, it's either because you have Indian parents or people like us who, you know, are raising your little children, so they might have a different idea, but if it's just in the culture, that's just what is known. And known almost thoughtlessly, because you're just brought up within that belief system. Not just in the West, I mean everywhere. It's like that little kids are born, they're born into the cultural containing myth. And that's what you take in, and it's at a very deep kind of foundational level. So if you just think about some of these differences and how they would affect us, like say in the West, this reincarnation or the transmigration of the jiva, that's something which is, at least on an intellectual level now in these last 10 years or so, it's very pervasive to the people. If I ask my students in class, if I'm doing East-West spiritual counseling class, or even in the other one in my introduction, I'll say, how many of you, you know, accept reincarnation as something that sits well with you? I'll say something like that. How does it sit well with you, or is it something that doesn't resonate with you? And I'd say almost 95% raise their hand and say that's how that sits well with me. That's what I accept. But that's being accepted now, because it makes sense. It makes life much more easier, because you're not squeezing your life into just one, you have this one chance, you know. It also takes care of a lot of problems, like why is there inequality among all of us, such different situations among all of us, when there's no cause for it? There's no prior condition. You didn't have a prior life to have gained punya and papa, you know. And so if you had the prior life and you gained this punya and papa, then that goes into the sanchitta. Then at the time of when you're leaving this body, when you're starting to travel, so to speak, to depart, at that time, the next set of prarabdha karma is attracted to who that person is right then and there. Those karmas resonate with that person. Even though, often Swamiji's joked about this also, there's beauty in it, but there's also a kind of a little laughter in it also. Because everybody wants to get a better birth in the next life, you want to, at that time of death, who are you at that time? Just when you make this crossing, this departure, where you've kind of, now you don't have control, you just are what you are, in terms of the subtle body, right? So there's no control at all. And so what you try to do, and what that your family members will do, would be whispering in your ear, you know, a mantra. Or like, say if your Ishta Devata is Shiva, for instance. Shiva, Om Namah Shivaya, 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 Om Namah Shivaya. So that's what's in your mind, right? And then Shiva, your Ishta Devata, will help you and bless you. But that's nice and beautiful. That's some nice punya, and you're invoking Shiva. But who you are at that time is something that's the culmination of who you are at the end, at the end of your life when you're ready to leave. So that you can't decide on what that is. There's no will left anymore. You're separated from your body. You're ready to depart. It's you're on your way. Okay? And so that one who is now on my way attracts the sanchitta karmas that cause you to take the next birth. And there's also, as I said yesterday, there's also you can be traveling to different lokas in order to exhaust punya or to exhaust papa, that type of thing. But you'll eventually come around, sometimes immediately, even you can immediately take another human birth. More than a few days, or you could take a human birth after some years, or after many years. You can be in an unmanifest condition, like deep sleep, you know, or you can be spending time, you know, in different lokas. But eventually, you will come back here. This is kind of the baseline where you're collecting and accruing karma. So that what's interesting is that you can, I mean, for say somebody who understands this is raised with it and all of that, there's a certain fairness in it, and a certain ownership. Like this is my karma this time around. You know, and this karma is in line with who I was in the last life, and that last life was in line with who I was the time before. Because I have an infinite sanchitta file, and so out of all of those karmas, which ones will I attract? I'll attract the ones that are meaningful for me. And if you look at it, say, in terms of your life, this life, you know, you today brings tomorrow, which brings the next day, and this month brings the next month, brings the next month. That's all interconnected. It's a string of interconnected karmas. So if you just kind of, that to me, that was helpful in my kind of, really kind of understanding it in a comfortable way. So think of it like this also. Say, this year, you know, brings on, so you have a bigger time space. This year, at the culmination of this year, whatever you are at the end of this year is what's is what initiates what you do this next year. And then that year, what you are at the end of that year will initiate, be in line with what you do the next year in terms of the person that you are. And so instead of drawing boundaries, permanent boundaries, you know, one birth, one death, we just see it as travel, as, you know, One set of clothes, you know, the next set of clothes, next set of clothes. It's like just a continuous life. It's a continuous life. We, when we don't have knowledge or recognize the stability of our own being and we have no idea what death is, we can still be afraid. Say you have self-ignorance and all of that and you think, well, we're hard been taught there's one birth and one death and we're coming upon this death now. I'm going to die, you know, and so you might have some beliefs, but I think there is an afterlife or I do believe in reincarnation. But even then, there's fear, because what you don't know is who really is it that reincarnates. Because the identification with the physical body and mind and this person that is named such and such and such and such is not going to be reincarnating. And so the one I care about is going to die and some soul or jiva, you know, is going to continue on. But the question would be like, what about me, you know? And so there's fear. There's fear to take that step often, you know? But the happy news is, in reference to this, is because there is no death and there is no travel, there is no death for the sukshma sharira, there's just continuation. Travel, and there is no death, no death experience. It doesn't actually exist. And so, just like when you wake up from the dream, there's no death experience at all, and nothing has happened to you. And so that's why a lot of times when people die, in their mind, when they die, there's a smile on their face, you know, because it's a little samadhi-like. You're leaving, you know, you're leaving all of the pains of that you've been carrying with you. You're leaving all of that, and you just have that moment of freedom and travel and the fact that you are not, don't go anywhere. You don't die. So these things, when the culture or when the teaching in the culture, or what the culture believes, when its containing myth matches what actually is. If the containing myth matches what actually is, then there's a relaxation. You know, I'd say like this: if the containing myth matches Vedanta, if the containing myth matches what you learn with the Vedanta or with this Upanishad Pramana, when it matches that, then there's a belief system that is not as frightening as a belief system where this is my only time, you know, and I will end up going permanently to hell or permanently to heaven. And God is up there somewhere looking down upon me, judging me. Once I, in the spiritual counseling class I had, you know, that was a big class. There was about 30 people. It's usually 15 people, but there's about 30 people. And there are two of the students were from Germany. I've told the story before, so you may have heard it. Two of the students were from Germany. They're sitting side by side. And we were going around just talking about what our childhood beliefs were, or what was our comfort level with God right now. When you think of God, or the God that you were raised with, what is your comfort level? And the one girl, she was probably 30, she said, she stood up and she said, "I never want to know him. I don't want to think about him. I do not want him in my life." And then, so we all kind of looked expectantly, you know, for a little bit more. And she said, "I don't like somebody always watching me and judging me. It really bothers me, you know, and so I don't like to think about it at all. I don't want somebody watching me, watching me to see if I'm going to make a mistake, you know. And so then I have to kind of be watching myself, you know, how is God watching me, you know, criticizing me." And that guy next to her is a young man, and he was also from Germany. But this isn't different. I'm just saying they just happen to be from Europe, that's all. It's not that the people in the States are very much different than this. But that idea of the other one said, "I don't like the fire and brimstone." You know?
What's that?
Fire and brimstone. There's an image, and there's even tarot cards of it, you know, where God is portrayed, is especially in the Old Testament, as someone who has lightning, fire and brimstone. Brimstone are like flaming rocks or something, and the lightning, you know, it's very frightening picture. So you see the picture of God holding this like lightning rod that can come down on you if you're bad, that type of thing. So there's a lot of fear of God based upon you being watched over by him, and when you make mistakes, then there's punishment. Well, in Vedanta, there's that too, because there's punya and papa. But the thing is that we have some, because of the Vedas and the first part of the Vedas, you kind of understand what punya and papa is. You know what dharma adharma is. You have some control over your accruing of punya and papa. And there's also neutralization of punya and papa. Okay, so we'll point this out. I'm just getting your minds going here for a little bit. We can talk. I can say there are prayers and rituals you can do to neutralize your punya and papa. Just like with the Catholics have confession. That's a huge neutralization. You go to confession and you list out the things that you are concerned with, the adharmas that bother you and that you feel bad about. And the priest will tell you to do, you know, 10 Hail Marys, or to do some, you know, the rosary. You know, do 10 rosaries, do so many Hail Marys, do so many Our Fathers. And then we'll give you blessings to release you from that papa. Like in Vedanta, they have the same thing. That's very positive, I think, you know. That there's some way to release your sins, you know, or the things that you're accrued. So I think in all, what I'm trying to say is in all the religions, there's There's good and bad things. There's different things. There are limiting things. There are different types of limitations. And some of the limitations are create a lot of pressure. Okay? I see the Christian religion as creating quite a bit of pressure, probably in Judaism also. Just for one reason is the one life. You have one chance. You have one heaven. You have one hell. You know, one chance, and both are eternal. You have one life, and so that means, what about all your desires? You know, when I was with my grandfather when he died, he was a great scholar and a historian, and his whole what he loved to do was read his history books. And you know, he had a big den, all of the walls, and in his room, all of the walls were covered with bookshelves from, you know, bottom to top, all history books. And when he was dying, he died in the middle of the night, that he said, there's so many more books I want to read. He's really, you know, yeah. It sounded like saying, there's so much more I want to read, there's so much more I want to know. You know. And this was the... This is his only time. He will be very happily surprised. But then you have to live with that pressure, you know. So sometimes it's interesting to hold really in some depth the belief system, or we call containing myth. The myth means the story, that the religious spiritual story that you are contained in. Contained in means you're born into it. It's like a fish in water. The water is the containing myth, as though for the fish. So there's not, you're born into it, and there's not really, at least when you're young, not any viveka there where you think, oh, that doesn't feel quite right, or, you know. It's just what is. It's not even an option. It's your reality. And so, what is your relation? What was your relationship with God when you were little, and how did your parents talk about God to you? You know, what you have to go back into your childhood, you know, and just go back in there and remember how you were. We were probably a religious child in some ways, because you're here. There's probably some things going on, and it's really. It's really beautiful to really spend some time. I think we'll do it in meditation tomorrow, but I'm introducing it now. It's such a beautiful thing to spend time with all of those beliefs. And you might have some little kind of magical beliefs too. You know, when I was little, I used to throw a stick, and then that's the direction I would walk in. Then I would throw it again, and I would walk. So I'd do this for a long time because I wanted to see, like, where was God going to take me? Throw the stick out in the forest. Those are little things. That means that you want a relationship. You want God to come and take care of you and tell you and help you, you know, and guide you. So it's just a child's way of doing that. So it's very good to kind of go back in and talk to that one. Talk to that God. Talk to God in the form of the child, the God that you were raised with. And then you might find that you feel worried, you know. You can feel worried, like, what is the God that I've always been with? Is he going to feel jealous or be angry, you know? Angry that I've left him and I'm going to some other God? What does he think? Or she think? You know? So you just have to think, and like, is there any kind of guilt or worry or any concern there when you made what you may consider to be some sort of a split or a breaking off from your childhood God to a different God? Even to think that there's a childhood God and a different God also is not really true. But that doesn't mean we don't think that way, you know. Like, even a Hindu can think that around their Ishtadevata, you know. You know, I used to just love Rama. And he was everything to me, you know, but I've kind of left him out, and I feel so bad about it, you know. I find I'm more connected with this Ishtadevata. My Ishtadevata has changed. Do you think Rama minds? Okay. I used to chant so many besides the Rudram every day. I had all these things by heart, and I kept adding. So I got up to Rudram, which takes about 6 minutes or so to chant. But then I chanted, you know, the stotrams to Durga, to Saraswati, to Lakshmi. So there was three, and then I wanted to do the Atharva Shirsha Upanishad. So I started adding. And at one point, there were too many. And I could not... I was an adult. I was not a child. I was a mature adult. Mature in age. Anyway. I could not give up one. Because how could I do that? And I was doing too many. So I stopped chanting. I did. Because I could. It's silly. I don't even know what to say about it. But that was what it was. I could not give one of them up and not give up the others. And it was taking way too much of my time. And then I was thinking, you know, if I ever do this again, which I never have, because I waited too long, and then I would have to learn all of these again. It's too much, like to learn Rudram again. I only remember like the first two anuvakas or so by heart. I can chant it if you're all chanting it or something, I can chant it, but I can't. And to go back and learn that all again, I just, you know. And then I think all the same thing would happen anyway. Okay, so this is, what can you say about that? I mean, I used to experience this in when I was little. I mean, don't tell me I'm the only one with this kind of conflict. I used to have the problem, you know, when you're supposed to say your prayers at night, and then you say, God bless mommy and daddy, and you have to bless everybody, and then you have to bless all of your brothers and sisters, and then you've got all of your nieces and nephews, you know, your cousins, you've got your cousins, and then, of course, the aunts and uncles, and then what about your friends, and then what about their mothers and fathers, because honestly, it just goes on and on, and where are you going to stop? Then those people don't get blessed. Did anybody have these conflicts? No? I did. I really did. Yeah, it was a really. I know people have, because people have admitted it to me, so I'm not totally alone. But what I'm saying, these are such childhood things, you know, they're childhood things. And another thing about the saying the prayers is that the prayers were all formal. Like the now I lay me down to sleep and different childhood prayers that your parents teach you. They're biblical prayers. You say these prayers and then you say these, you know, you bless everybody. But you're not really supposed to bless yourself, you know. Like I couldn't, it would be wrong and improper to say, I really want a new bike, you know, or I really want to go with my friends to that party tomorrow night. Can you make my parents say yes? No, you don't get to say anything like that. You know why? Because God is too busy. He's too busy. You know, he has too much to do to hear these silly prayers. So that's really wrong to take up his time like that. So these are childhood things, you know. But then there they are inside. You know, they play out in various ways. For me, I don't know that they play out anymore. But I remember. I remember all this when I was little. And because of all of that, I've always made a point to how to have a relationship with Bhagavan that is as deep and personal of a relationship as you have with your dearest partner or dearest friend. You know, where you have a real conversation and all of the things that you want and all of the things that you're worried about and concerned about all of your aspirations, everything, all of your likes and dislikes, what you're working on as a mamuksha, the things in yourself that you're working on, and you know, and even what you want, you know. Oh, no, I'm a mamuksha. I'm not supposed to want anything. Yeah. What if you want something? If you feel that way, you could say, Bhagavan, I know I'm a mamuksha. I'm not supposed to want anything. But these are the things I want, you know. And then you have to say like this, but only if they're good for me. Mm-hmm. You have to get around these things.
Yeah.
That's a real relationship. So the one that, if you haven't done this, this may be something that you've worked on way in the past and it's not relevant, but I think it's always relevant because you always get something new, some new tidbit, is to go back into that childhood God, you know, and talk to him. These are my concerns, you know. Do you think that I did anything wrong? Are you mad at me in any way? Whatever the little child in there might be feeling, you know. See if there is the child is feeling anything. Maybe, you know. It may be feeling something. It may not be certain, you know. And then let Bhagavan tell you what to do. And Bhagavan's an adult. He's an adult. We can say that. He's not going to say, you know, I'm so jealous. I really wish you hadn't done that. I don't think so. Even in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, Bhagavan says, in whatever form you worship me, in that form I come to you. That's Ishtadevata. In whatever form you worship me, in that form I come to you. That is so beautiful, you know. And so God has to become bigger than the childhood God. And even though I'm kind of revving all of this up now, we might not have done much of this, it's important to do because it's all there in the unconscious. And if you kind of haven't, you know, had these kind of conversations or kind of go back and remember your childhood and remember going to church and remember your way you prayed and the way you thought about God and the little maybe games, like the little game I told you I used to play, and, you know, did you ever open the Bible and put your finger over like this? Put your finger there and then look and see, and that would be a special message. There's all kinds of these little things that we would do because we want that relationship. You know? So now it's good to go back and bring that real relationship, the relationship you actually have. Go back to that beginning and bring it up to the present, you know, with Bhagavan's blessings or with the God of the little child's blessing you for the God of the present. Bringing the little child's God up to the present. See what I mean? So it makes a difference, and it makes a big difference to have that kind of permission. To have that permission so that you can actually, as Ishvara is being unfolded, and you're recognizing really a somewhat different perspective of God. I say somewhat, because when we get deeply into Christian mysticism or into some of the ancient philosophers like St. Thomas Aquinas, you know, there are some very deep, deep similarities. Like, for instance, St. Thomas Aquinas talked about God as the absolute simplicity of being, you know. And he talked about the creation as the, and others too, not only Thomas for this one, not only St. Thomas Aquinas, and others have followed him also. But the absolute simplicity of being, I love that. Just being, such it, you know. That is Brahman. And then what about this creation? This particular Latin term is prevalent within the theologies. Creatio ex nihilo. This creation comes from nothing. Yama iti maya. It has no independent being of its own. it's not like there was a bunch of wood and sticks and earth and stuff to there, and then God came and built the whole earth, you know, and then, you know, blew some air around it. No. There's no prior condition. That's the same. We say there's no prior condition. And even when the creation is here, it has no independent being. Creatio means, you know, the creation. Ex nihilo, it comes from nothing. Not non-existence, because here's the creation, you know. But it has no prior condition, as though here's the creation, and within this creation we're going to build things. We're going to build it up. But there's no materials there. No materials to build it up with. The five elements come into manifestation. And so there's so many things. If you read the Christian mystics, for instance, like Saint Teresa in the, what's that word, name of that? The interior castle that has seven rooms go in. When you get to that seventh room, having gone through all of these shadow elements, it's kind of Jungian. She was prior to Jung, but it's kind of Jungian in her approach. It's going inward, 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 and you go through all the monsters and all the scary things, and then inward, inward. So you get to that interior castle. And what she says, I was actually, when I really studied this, I'd already been to India. But I was so excited to see it, because in that interior castle, she goes, even though we can't say this theologically, she says, in terms of the experience, there is no difference between, there's only one self. There is no experience of two. That was so beautiful, because going just right to the nature of the self. She went through all the upadis, each upadi like a room. She went through all of the rooms and all of the unconscious stuff that was holding, but when she got to that which is the pratyagatma, the innermost, you know, then that was there is no separation between the individual and the divine. There's no separation. And she says, I know we can't say this theologically, but nevertheless, that's experience. So I had one of these yellow marker pens, and it was I marked it all, and I made little red notes in the margins. So in all of the different, actually, in so many, I can't say all because none of us know all, but in so many, in the mystical traditions, you know, there is one reality here, and that one reality is what we all experience. We define it and talk about it in different ways. But the recognition of what some will call a union with God, you know, is so common in all of the different traditions. But there's a sense of union of the jiva, the soul, coming into union. So two, coming into union. Because that you experience that oneness by coming into a union with God, especially in the mystical traditions. But we wouldn't say union. It is a recognition that the innermost being, which is myself, that is Ishvara. Why we say it is Ishvara is because that Maya, in unmanifest condition, is there. It doesn't have any place else to go. So if you accept the Maya as being an incidental attribute of the self, that means it doesn't bring about any change to the self. And that is Ishvara, so you can call it God. You have to know what you're talking about. You know, you have to be able to make that differentiation between Brahman and the Maya Upadi, the Satya Mitya. But Maya has no other place to be other than in yourself. And so then from the self, this creation comes, it's sustained, and it resolves. And so what is at the bottom of everything and every one of us is just that one non-dual self, which is God. Which is Ishvara. It's nobody else. So I am nobody. There aren't two of us. That's what's so beautiful also for us to understand in reference to this creation. Even if you say this creatio ex nihilo, a Christian term, it means that this creation has no being apart from the self. You know? And then you have to recognize that that self is me. And so this creation is my creation. Everything, all the laws, everything that is going on, this all comes from me, is sustained by me, and resolves back into me. There's no separate being out there. There is one being, which from the standpoint, one me, one conscious being, that from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs, you know, I become a part of Ishvara. From the standpoint of the Upadis, I am a part of God, as are all beings and all the trees and everything that exists, is part of the whole. But actually, I am as much the self as the whole as I am the self of every individual jiva. Just like when you have an imagination, you're the self of the whole imagination, and you're the self of absolutely every part of that whole, including the smallest microbes and the atoms and the quarks. There is nothing that does not depend upon you and have you for its being, you know. And so you can find so much of Vedanta and even in Judaism, there's a lot there also, and especially in the Kabbalah. I haven't studied that as much, but I've studied it enough to know. So the thing that Vedanta has that is so powerful is the pramana. Is that a very, very, very systematic method of taking the student step by step by step to the actual recognition of that reality, the aparoksha jnana, to actually recognizing I am that. Not the Shastra says I am that, or not Jesus says I am that. He says so many things that are Mahavakyas, you know. But I have to be able to see that. And so the very great gift, I think, of India and of the Vedic culture is that, and it can be there in other traditions too. It could be in the, I know from people I am close to who are in the Tibetan tradition who have studied with Swamiji, that there's certain Tibetan traditions that are very close, hard to distinguish from Vedanta. There can be that in the mystical traditions also of other religions. We just don't necessarily know, because most people don't anyway, you know, because you're not interested. That's not your calling, so you don't know what's out there. But we know what this is, and it's so beautiful and it's so thorough. You know, and it makes you see, because it's a pramana. That's what the Upanishads are. So something very, very sacred. So we have that blessing. So I would say tomorrow we're going to, in the meditation, I'm just saying, because you can start thinking about these things now, just, you know, prime the pump a little bit at night, because in the morning we're going to have this meditation. We actually go in and, you know, be with yourself a little bit. Those beliefs, and some of them were probably a blessing for you, and some of them might have been a little frightening. Not a blessing. And also just your relationship with God, and get that permission. If you need to get the permission, get the permission that it's really okay to see you as Ishvara. Bhagavan should say, that's absolutely okay. Like, you could see me as a leaf. You can see me as a rock. You can see me in any way you want, and I would bless you in that way. So that's the tradition.